Everyone can recognize wisdom in the public figures and family members that possess it, but it doesn't matter whether you're a philosopher, a neuroscientist, a theologian, or a psychologist. Dare to try, because dare to try to define wisdom, and you're going to run into trouble. Stephen S. Hall doesn't... You see, I suddenly was very unwise there. I didn't trust my own writing. Stephen S. Hall doesn't claim to be an expert. He is a science journalist, and he's written what he calls an unauthorized account of the science of wisdom. Mr. Hall has written for the New York Times Magazine. He has 5 previous books to his credit. And this new one, Wisdom, From Philosophy to Neuroscience, is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased that brings him to our show today. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing?
You say your book is wholly speculative, deeply unauthorized. Were you hoping to invent a framework for something scientists don't admit to studying?
In a sense, I was. My approach, interestingly, was to kind of take a reductionist idea, which is the approach that scientists do, to break an idea down to some component parts and then examine it more closely. And I knew I couldn't define wisdom definitively because people have been trying to do it for 2,500 years and haven't been able to do it successfully. So I wanted to work around the idea, reduce the idea, and then look at the science behind those parts.
Well, neuroscientists are reluctant to say they're studying wisdom, but are they?
I think a lot of them are studying components of wisdom, and they don't like to think that they're doing that in part because it doesn't embellish one's scientific reputation to study something you can't define or measure. But you can define and measure emotion regulation, for example, altruism, compassion, and there's active neuroscience going on in all these areas.
Well, wisdom is something that we normally would think of as a philosophical area.
Well, I would say it used to belong to philosophy, but that has ceased to be the case. They're not the sole custodians of the idea. Obviously, theology for a very long time played a very major role in defining wisdom. The psychologists entered the scene about 50 years ago with Erik Erikson, the great 20th century philosopher who really invoked wisdom as kind of a later stage in life. And then the psychologists started defining what wisdom was like. And I kind of used their definition to go back and look at neuroscience.
Well, what is their definition? I was even wondering whether it's easier to define wise people than to define wisdom.
In a sense, it is. You know, there are two short kind of quotations that I've used as a guide to get into the subject, one of which, you know, Potter Stewart, the Supreme Court Justice, famously said, "I can't define pornography, but I know it when I see it." And I thought that was actually very applicable to wisdom because a lot of people have had a hard time defining it, but they know it when they see it. And they do see it, usually in their private lives, more in their public lives, but they know it. Coming from the other side, from the philosophical side, Robert Nozick, who's the Harvard philosopher, contemporary philosopher, said that wisdom is knowing what's important. And that's actually an incredibly flexible and interesting definition because there's a lot of things behind it, including scientific things and how our brains work that define what's important.
Well, my dictionary says wisdom understands what is true, right, or lasting. It's insight, common sense, good judgment, the sum of scholarly learning.
It's a little bit of all those things, but it's also the sum of human experience. I think the human nature, the knowledge of human nature, for example, is a huge component in that, the kind of thing that one cultivates over the course of a lifetime, which is why people have always thought perhaps you have a better chance of being wise when you're older than when you're younger, although that may not entirely be true.
Well, it's true up to the point where you remember all the things that you should remember, and then for some people... that no longer applies. I mean, we think of old age as being both a time when people can be wise and when they lose it.
There's this kind of narrow window of possibility for wisdom before cognitive degradation sets in, and you can't remember the things that you've learned. Although a number of studies have shown that older people are actually pretty good at being able to continue to learn, hone their cognitive skills, perhaps not as quick as younger people, but maybe have more of a database to work with in a sense.
My guest is Stephen S. Hall. His latest book, Wisdom, From Philosophy to Neuroscience, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is wisdom even necessary? Can a person live without it?
I think wisdom has always been and continues to be important. I think it's harder to think about it today. because I think there are a lot of claims on our time, and particularly on our time for reflection, which I think is an important component of wisdom. I think a lot of our new technologies just continue to nudge us, prod us into the present tense, and so we don't have this time to step back and reflect.
But you also get the sense that some people are just born with it, that phrase, he was wise beyond his years.
One of the interesting studies, when the psychologists started looking at this in those 1970s, 1980s, one of the groups, which was based in Berlin, had something called the Berlin Wisdom Project. And what they did was try to place the roots of wisdom. And one of the things they discovered is that it seemed to occur much earlier than old age. At least the seeds of it made themselves apparent much earlier in life. The suggestion has been made that encountering adversity early in life might, in some sense, tune one's emotional tissue to adjusting to things like change, unpredictability, unexpected things. And that's a really important part of wisdom, being able to deal with those kinds of issues.
But the Berlin Wisdom Paradigm is not one of the more famous meetings. Is that because wisdom studies on the fringes of academic respectability?
You know, it was, even when it began in the 70s and 80s, however, the people who did study it were actually very prominent in psychology. One of them was Robert Sternberg, who was very well known in intelligence theory and was at Yale for 30 years. Another was Paul Baltus, who was kind of one of the founding figures of lifespan developmental psychology, which is a really influential school of psychology that looks at how people's lives and psychology change over the course of a lifetime because of cultural events, historical events, things that have happened in their lives. It's a kind of longitudinal way of thinking about psychology.
What got you thinking about this? Was it that article you wrote for the New York Times Magazine about the relationship between wisdom and age?
Yeah, it was. I got into this at I backed into it in an interesting way. The Times Magazine asked me to do this story for a baby boom generation issue. And I said I'd be interested in doing the article. And I said, what did you have in mind? And they said, well, we've heard there's research about wisdom. And as you know from my prior appearances on your show, I mostly write about very hardcore science and molecular biology and genetics. And my stomach kind of sunk. And I thought, oh, God, this is never going to work out. But as I started to read the literature, I really got fascinated with all this thinking about how do we reach good decisions? What constitutes a good decision in our life? What are the important things to make decisions about? So I really became kind of wrapped by the idea of wisdom.
And the cover of the book has an image of cultured neurons.
It's a beautiful image because it suggests this kind of connected, associative quality of wisdom where you're drawing on a variety of things, this kind of emotional resilience on the one hand, but also knowledge that you've accumulated from books or life experience on the other hand, and humility, compassion. You're drawing upon all these different qualities in a neural network that you're kind of forging through the course of a lifetime.
Do you think that thinking about wisdom makes you wiser?
Let me say this. It really affected my approach to problems and problem solving when I started doing the Times article, which is what really got me into this. I found after reading about wisdom, and I hope any reader of this book has the same experience, that I began to stop and step back and reflect on sort of what the everyday problem coming up. And they come up, you know, I think everybody has problems that come up four or five times a day, whether it's with work colleagues, children, family, life decisions, career decisions. And taking the time to step back and think about it, I thought created a sort of sense of armchair mindfulness, if you will. I just was paid a little bit more attention to the decisions and how I was going about making them.
Why do you say thinking about wisdom can also be paralyzing?
If you think wisdom, a lot of people think of wisdom as sort of sucking on your thumb and thinking about things, but it actually is very closely connected to action. So wisdom that's divorced from action is actually not wisdom at all. It's just thinking about things. It's just being reflective.
But that's the guru at the top of the mountain. We go and we ask, what is the meaning of life?
Well, but interestingly, and this gets into the neuroscience, so there's a group at the University of Wisconsin that has been studying Buddhist meditators, meditating about compassion. And they've been putting together a little neural circuitry. And one of them involves just understanding another person's suffering, which is one component of compassion, kind of feeling it in one's own body, which is a second component of this. And then the third part of the brain that they see active during this exercise is one related to action. So in other words, you're seeing this little circuitry being forged and strengthened that has to do with understanding another person's suffering, feeling it, and then having that as a motivation for action.
But aren't there some pretty smart people who really aren't moved by other people's suffering? Most of them, as far as I can see, are policymakers in Washington.
Yes. Barbara Tuchman wrote a wonderful essay called The Persistence of Unwisdom in Government. So if you're going to talk about Washington, I think that's an unwise place in many respects.
Compassionate conservatives, although I haven't seen too many.
That may be more of a slogan than a philosophy or a theology. I think the compassion runs very strongly through Buddhism, Confucianism, the Judeo-Christian tradition. It's really an essential component of understanding another person's thought processes, where they're coming from, as a precursor to decision making, how you deal with people like that.
But there isn't a necessary link between intelligence and wisdom.
No. And in fact, the psychologists who started to look at this interestingly made the point that if you test for intelligence, there are correct answers to every question you ask. But when you test for wisdom, there are no correct answers. The thought behind that being that wisdom is very contextual, so that the correct answer in one situation is actually going to be absolutely the wrong answer in another, and developing this sense, this intuitional feel for which answer is the best in a given situation, I think, is what elevates wisdom and distinguishes it from mere intelligence.
Were there some unanswered questions that you wanted to address in this book?
I think the science is very, very early. In fact, again, as I mentioned in the book, when I embarked on this project, there was nobody talking about the neuroscience of wisdom. I turned in the draft of the book about a year ago, March, and a month after I turned it in, there was an article in the Archives of General Psychiatry, a review article that was entitled The Neurobiology of Wisdom. So it's just begun to be part of the conversation. And I liken it, and I have talked to people in neuroscience about this, I liken it to kind of where memory and emotion research was at the very beginning. They were ill-defined concepts that everybody knew was important. And subsequently, the research has gotten much better because the research itself has honed the definition.
Well, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll look at what people have thought about wisdom throughout the ages as we continue this conversation with Stephen Hall, who's written about the intersection of science and society in books, magazine articles, and essays, primarily in the New York Times Magazine, author of 6 books, some of which have brought him to our show. And now the 6th is Wisdom, From Philosophy to Neuroscience. It's published by Knopf. Stay with us for more. We're back with Stephen S. Hall. His latest book, Wisdom, From Philosophy to Neuroscience, published by Knopf. Who was Vivian Clayton, and what was her contribution to the study of science? I mean, of wisdom.
Vivian Clayton was a doctoral student in psychology at the University of Southern California in the 1970s. And her role in this grows out of the fact that wisdom studies actually grew out of gerontology a little bit. There had been a long history of studying essentially just cognitive and physical decline in elderly people, and there was nothing really good about aging. And in the 70s, there was a movement to say, maybe there's some good things about growing old, and we should try to identify them and investigate them psychologically. She worked in the laboratory of James Beeren, who's a very well-known lifespan psychologist, gerontological psychologist at USC. And she proposed the idea of looking at wisdom, and he encouraged her to do this. And so she went back and read the Hebrew Bible, and she read ancient texts, trying to define the idea of wisdom, and then begin to do some empirical studies about it. So that was actually the very beginning of psychological studies of wisdom.
And she looked into the whole matter of the differences between public and private versions of wisdom?
Well, she was really focused on the role of judges, especially in these biblical tales, where you were trained to in a discipline of decision-making that would be kind of aligned to justice, but also compassion. And so she was trying to formulate a definition of wisdom around those ideas.
And if you look up wisdom in the dictionary, one of the things that comes up is the wisdom of Solomon.
The wisdom of Solomon. Although in the book, actually, I went back and read the entire story of Solomon, not just the famous case of him deciding the woman whose baby was about to be cut in half. And the trajectory of his life is actually not entirely wise. I mean, he started out as a rather ruthless young man in eliminating rivals for the throne. And by the end of his life, God had become so fed up with his violation of the covenants that he had agreed to that he essentially took away his inheritance from his children because of the way he had behaved. So Solomon, I think, is a good example of that wisdom is a difficult thing to achieve, and you're not internally wise, but you maybe have moments of wisdom.
Why did Vivian Clayton quit studying wisdom in the early 1980s?
I think she got a little bit overwhelmed with this whole idea of how difficult it was to define. I think as some of these larger figures in psychology entered the field, maybe the maneuvering room was a little bit more difficult. She ended up being a neuropsychologist in Northern California. I actually tracked her down through an article that was about beekeeping, which turns out to be interesting because hive psychology and sort of altruistic behavior has become a very hot area of psychology now.
But one of the ideas that you address here is why knowledge benefits the young and emotional stability benefits the old. Are they both forms of wisdom?
I think they're both crucial to wisdom. You're actually referring to a study that I think is very interesting, and I talked about it in the Times article, but really convinced me that there may be neuroscience attached to this. It was a group at Stanford who was comparing the sort of emotional regulation of both older and younger people. And what they found is that younger people seem to be more, as you said, knowledge-driven, interested in acquiring knowledge, but they also seem to be more susceptible to kind of negative emotional events. In other words, they tended to cling to negative outcomes. They didn't reset their thermostat emotionally. They weren't resilient, whereas older people seem to have this ability, possibly because of degradation a little bit. Nobody knows for sure, but were able to bounce back from these negative events.
But I'm not sure that older people don't just accumulate more knowledge to the point where they can't retrieve it all, but it's all there.
It is all there, but I think it's picking.
I remember everything I learned. It just takes me time to remember it all.
Well, if you can remember everything, that's fantastic. I think we all have these large databases of experience, but it's the choosing and editing of it and knowing which, to get back to the Nozick idea, knowing what's important. You really have to edit the information you have to really determine what's important.
When did people even start thinking about the nature of wisdom? Does it go back to Socrates? Or
it goes
earlier?
Back to ancient Greek philosophy, and the idea... the animating idea and why it's still important today is what drives our behavior in life, what constitutes a good life, what constitutes the best decisions, the benefit not only personally, our personal happiness, but also that of our families and our constituent groups.
And these are the same sorts of questions that Confucius was asking, that Buddha was asking?
Exactly. And part of what I did was to go back and look at these various definitions of wisdom from these various schools. And a lot is often made of the differences between various schools, and there are differences. What I focused on were the congruences, in other words, areas where there was agreement. And out of that, I kind of arbitrarily selected these 8 neural pillars of wisdom that I then looked at the science behind. But it involves things like moral judgment, which clearly is important in all those schools. Again, compassion, humility, dealing with uncertainty and unexpected events is a really important part of this formula because we don't live in a static world. Our environment is changing all the time. And our brain, frankly, is probably the organ that is most important in adjusting to change and making the right adaptation.
Confucius was able to impose his idea of wisdom on others. In fact, many religions have as well.
You see this evolution in the definition of wisdom where the definition becomes theological in the Middle Ages and it stops being a secular idea. One of the great revolutions in Greek thought, I think, was that wisdom was seen as a human virtue, that is a self-generated virtue dependent on insight, disciplined thought, that sort of thing. With the arrival of Christianity, frankly, it became a non-secular idea. It was a divine gift from God, and that the Renaissance essentially, it took till the Renaissance to wrest that idea back to secular terms.
But we see that in other religions as well. The rabbi or the imam who is chosen because he's the wisest guy in town.
Well, we all both crave wisdom in our leaders and hope they have it. Whether they actually do or not is always a question. I actually was I've been blogging about wisdom since the book came out and my website. And one of the things I discussed was Barack Obama's behavior leading up to the passage of the health care bill, and also some stuff that had been reported otherwise. And it struck me that a lot of his characteristics actually align a little bit with some of these age-old determinants of wisdom.
Well, it all depends on who you are. If you're a member of the Tea Party, you don't see that. How much is wisdom in the eyes of the beholder?
I think there's a little bit of that, but I think there again, if you to these basic qualities, I don't see a lot of compassion in Tea Party politics, for example, but I think that's a really essential part of wisdom. And it's a difficult part because it involves some degree of self-sacrifice in a way for the benefit of the larger group.
So when you say that altruism and compassion are aspects of wisdom, well, for years, Alan Greenspan was considered the wisest man in economics, and now he's being criticized from all quarters. He was somebody who believed in Ayn Rand's philosophy, and she didn't believe in altruism.
You know, one of the interesting things that when I went back then through the literature of wisdom was this realization that many of the people who we now, with the test of time, consider wise had very adversarial relationships with their contemporary society. So Socrates, most obviously, because he was put on trial and put to death, but also Confucius was kind of on the outs in his society. The Buddha essentially renounced family and typical society. And you can go through Gandhi.
Jesus did as well.
Jesus, obviously. So we think of wise people as someone that we embrace their wisdom and think that what they say informs our judgment. But often they are adversarial to what's considered conventional wisdom. Mm-hmm. Truly wise people sometimes oppose conventional wisdom.
My guest is Stephen S. Hall, whose latest book is called Wisdom, From Philosophy to Neuroscience, published by Knopf. A lot of the research in the book centers on watching the brain in action using functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. What do they do? They ask people questions and watch what parts of the brain light up?
Exactly. And one of the more interesting aspects of the research as I began to get more deeply into it is noticing that, you know, at the end of a scientific paper, they cite all the people who have done previous research in this area. And I started seeing names like Aristotle and John Stuart Mills and John Rawls and David Hume. So a lot of philosophers were starting to crop up in these brain imaging studies. And the idea was that the scientists are posing tasks or dilemmas while people's are inside these brain scans machines, so they can see what the brain is doing when they're resolving a moral dilemma, for example, or they're trying to solve an issue of social equity and justice. And you actually begin to see the circuitry begin to emerge for different tasks.
So different people's brains light up differently?
They have
and
different...
And can you spot one, a wise brain, as a result?
Not necessarily. You can't see wisdom in a scan. I think we're a long way from that. But what you can see are neural circuits involved in particular tasks. It might be altruism, you know, identifying a situation that is unjust and trying to do something about it. Compassion, which I mentioned before, a circuitry that seems to be involved in moral judgment. Pairing that that reality to the main message from neuroscience, at least that I've taken away in the last 10 or 15 years, which is that the brain is actually plastic. It's not fixed. It's not hardwired in the way that you always hear, but in fact is actually a little bit malleable on the basis of human experience and also human exertion, including mental exertion, which is precisely why Buddhist meditators' brain scans are different from, you know, normal people's.
Is meditation a way of attaining wisdom, as a Buddhist might tell you?
I think meditation is a way of exercising the mind in a way that most of us don't do. And I think it's a great object lesson for a lot of people that, the like muscles in the body, the muscle of the brain can not only be exercised but fortified by concerted mental effort.
Although I remember going to a teaching by a very celebrated Tibetan Rinpoche, who kept on talking about how much humility he had and was bragging at the same time that this movie star was in the audience, one of his followers. So there are other factors.
There are absolutely other factors. Humility is a really interesting component, and I actually talked about humility in a chapter in the book. Gandhi is a really interesting example of this, because on the one hand, you have someone who exemplified humble behavior, and yet at the other, on the other hand, had this unbelievably fierce heart in order to achieve what he achieved in the face, again, of another person who was adversarial to his particular society.
And then he did things that shocked me, like he would test himself by sleeping with a young woman. I've always thought about that, like what was going on in the head of the young woman who was his test of strength of will?
Well, I don't know what was going on in her head, but I suspect what was going on in his head was some sort of exertion, obviously. Willpower is one way of thinking about it, to resist that temptation. But this, again, goes back all the way to the Socratic distinction between, you know, the impulse of the body and the exercise of the mind. And Socrates always said that wisdom resided in the pursuit of the mind at the expense of the body. In fact, he said you almost have to die in order to be wise.
Do patience and delayed gratification come more easily with age?
I'm not sure if they come more easily with age, but I think we maybe have more tricks in terms of cognitive strategies or willpower, if you will, to kind of tamp down some of those impulses.
Is that something you could see in the brain?
I think they're starting to see that. They have done experiments where people are offered either immediate rewards or delayed rewards, and they can see which parts of the brain are particularly active when you decide for a delayed gratification as opposed to immediate one. I hasten to say that these are early days for this stuff, but the fact they can even see it, I think, is really fascinating.
Well, does everyone agree that things like compassion and altruism are components of wisdom?
I don't think everybody necessarily agrees. I actually took more of my cues from the psychologists who looked at this than the philosophers, because I thought the psychologists had a more rounded sense of the behavioral qualities that would lend themselves to wise behavior. So there's never been agreement on what the definition of wisdom is. And I didn't intend to provide one in this book, but I intended to wrestle with a lot of different ones.
Well, you say that altruism is a distinctly social aspect of wisdom, but do different cultures define and measure altruism in different ways?
I'm sure they do, but there is this notion of altruism, which actually arose in biology. It arose with social insects, and it was something that Darwin, for example, was extremely concerned about, because he thought it would torpedo his notion of natural selection if you had people, organisms sacrificing themselves for the greater good of the group. There's now a lot of biology that backs up why there would be altruistic behavior and why it would be biological.
You suggested earlier that some of the new technologies, things like Twitter, for example, are enemies of wisdom. In what way?
I think everything from cell phones, which make us immediately reachable, checking our email, Twitter, all these things perturb and interrupt these moments of reflection when maybe we can step back and think about things.
Well, multitasking is the norm today, and studies have indicated that multitaskers actually wind up only getting superficial information from all the different tasks.
I think the multitasking studies, and there's another one coming out next week actually, indicate that there's a very narrow amount of extra work that you can do when you're multitasking. And it doesn't get away from this problem. You're not just receiving information or gathering it. You have to edit it. And the more information that comes in, the harder it is to edit. So the more we're gathering without editing, I think we're disadvantaging ourselves.
I grew up in the generation that started multitasking, listening to the radio, to my favorite radio, rock and roll in those days, while I was doing my homework. I was a terrible student. Now I know why.
My son does the same thing, and he seems to be doing okay, though. So it's always dangerous to generalize.
You say we hunger for wisdom to forestall spiritual and existential death. Is human awareness of death essential for wisdom?
I think, as far as we know, humans are the only creatures that are aware in advance of their own mortality. And I think that puts an added burden on defining how one wants to live one's life. And I think that really was an essential component to the original concept of wisdom.
It may also explain why Zeus was often so unwise, because he was an immortal. He had no sense of his death.
He didn't need to worry about it, exactly. He had a license to be unwise.
How essential is the research suggesting family is in developing wisdom? Is it different if somebody grows up pretty much on his own as opposed to in a rich family environment?
I think the research on altruism suggests that there's a part of human biology, and again, it's addressed by this notion of what's called social neuroscience now, that a lot of what we do is dependent on advancing the goals of a larger group, and that group often is obviously a family, but it could also be a congregation, a community, a neighborhood, whatever. But it's very important to have this sense of, you know, sacrifice in the interests of a larger group, that in the long run that may be beneficial, even though in the short run it involves sacrifice for the individual, which from the biological point of view always seemed to be something that didn't make sense.
My guest, Stephen S. Hall, has won numerous awards. In 2004, the Science in Society Journalists Award for book writing from the National Association of Science Writers. The latest, I suspect, will also do well for him. It's called Wisdom, From Philosophy to Neuroscience, published by Knopp. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.